movies and booze on Moncrief.
Brought to you by Lidl's award-winning wine range. Lidl, more for you.
Five 3106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or send us an email to afternoon@newstalk.com. It is indeed time for movies and booze, but we should refer back to some of the items we've been talking about already. We were talking to Simon, one of the designers behind a thing they simply call the Bum, which they call a wearable, but it's kind of like a reverse Spanx. If you wear it under your clothes, it gives you Kim Kardashian's bum. Does it sag with the weight? A saggy Kim Kardashian bum sounds awful and sad, says the texter. It would sound sad, especially, say, if you went out and then it started raining. You probably couldn't risk wearing it in Ireland, because then it would become waterlogged and then your arse would be dragging behind you on the ground. That wouldn't be a good look. It's called a cushion, says another. Well, yes, but this is a crafted cushion. And they've done 3D computer modelling to make it look exactly like her backside. To be honest, I'm surprised it took this long for someone to create this. Aha! Very astute. Apparently somebody has already. But the way these people have done it, it appeared at London Fashion Week and now they're in New York. So it's supposedly high-end fashion. If you can't sit in it, then what's the actual point? A bum is to cushion you. Nah, I'm out, says this texter. Okay, well, that's probably the end of their dreams. At the same time, all they have at the moment is a kind of a prototype, which is obviously heavy and large, and you can't sit in it. But if it goes into commercial production, presumably they'll come up with something in which you can do all those things. I think you should be allowed to buy that bum deflated, but with zips on each cheek, so you can have it down as your back for the day. You definitely fit your phone, purse, snack, tissues, maybe a charger, your Filofax, spare underwear, a few hair clips, some random receipts in the arse. It's definitely big enough for all that, possibly more. That's a very good point, and a very practical point. On a night out, you wouldn't have to carry a bag. You could just wear your Kim Kardashian backside and everything you need is there. We were talking as well about the fact that it's the 80th anniversary of the Tom and Jerry cartoons. They have newer Tom and Jerry animations on now, but it's as for babies or something. They are so sedate, nothing exciting, no real chases, all a bit lifeless. Says this texter, well, you know, as we were saying during the course of that conversation, the original one was, by today's standards, quite violent for kids. And, you know, there was a few racist stereotypes in there as well, to boot. On the question of chess boxing, texter wants to know, do they have to keep the boxing gloves on while they play chess? That would be worth watching, says Jackie. No, as you heard, they take them off, they play chess for 3 minutes, then they put the gloves back on, then they do another 3 minutes of beating the hell out of each other, then they take the gloves off, then they sit down and play chess. Ed says chess is considered a mind sport. Somebody did text in saying that it sounds like a made up sport, like hurlgabi. Someone says hurlgabi sounds like an ailment you get in the groin. Does it now? Sounds like someone's a bit familiar with that. Did he not say Velcro the chess pieces down, or was that his boxing gloves? The boxing gloves. There were a fair few people did tweet me as well to let me know that Bunratty Annual Chess Festival starts today for 3 days. And there are 325 chess players, from Grandmaster to those just starting out. Maybe after a few drinks, there might be a few fights as well. I'm delighted to say that we have the collective fabulousness that is Jean Smollett and Esther McCarthy with us once again.
Hello.
Good afternoon to you both.
Do you know what I want to know? You know the way, does my bum look big in this? And the man's supposed to say, oh no, darling. Is he now supposed to say, oh, it does. It does, really big.
Yeah,
what he's supposed to say is
it doesn't look big enough. If he says it doesn't look big enough, then there'll be a row. Because she's after throwing out 500 quid on a fake arse.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Jesus, I can see the rouse.
I had a man say that to me.
As usual, we never know what to say, basically. Just nod and say whatever you think yourself, you know. That's the best policy. So, Jean, before we talk about our Spanish wines, you've things to plug.
I have lots of things to plug. First of all, there's a great tasting coming up on the 9th of March, the Wine Wars Tasting. It's on in Fade Street Social. Tickets are on sale at €25. Dylan McGrath is going to be doing some food. You'll also get tickets online from Celtic Whiskey Shop, or or you'll, on my website, I have a link, jeansmullen.com. It's a number of importers have teamed up and they're going to have a series of consumer wine tastings, and this is the first of them. So Faith Street Social on the 9th of March, it's called Wine Wars Tasting. And then Kelly's Hotel. Ah, everybody loves Kelly's. They have a wine week starting on the 14th, from the 1st to the 6th of March. In fact, this year is their 125th season. They're 125 years in business.
Crikey.
Isn't that amazing? So anyway, the 1st to the 6th of March, they have a wine appreciation week with Julie Dupuy, who is one of Ireland's
she's been
tops,
on with us. Yes, yes.
Sommeliers. Yeah. And Benjamin Leroux from the Côte d'Or, from Burgundy, who'll be featuring his wine. So you can book in for the whole week, or you can just go to the wine dinner or the wine tastings. But kellys.ie has all the information. So that's Wine Wars and Kelly's there. That's a great way to start the
wine. Right, okay. Wine
spring.
Wars. What's like war
they,
about the
I don't know
if
they've just called
it
Wine Wars. I presume it's some kind of a marketing name.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Hopefully it doesn't turn violent. So what wines are we talking about today in our wine wars?
Again, spring's around the corner and there's lots of wine sales coming up. Now, Lidl have a French wine sale starting on the 2nd of March, and they have loads of great wines, and I'm sure we'll be featuring them in the next couple of weeks. O'Brien's have an Italian wine sale starting on the 4th of March, which was running till the 18th. And at the moment, Supervalue have a fabulous Spanish wine sale. That's the first time I've seen actually a Spanish wine sale. It's running until the March 4th, so we're going to feature a Spanish wine that's in their sale. And then go to an old favourite of mine, New Zealand Pinot Noir, made by a friend of mine, Matt Thompson, very good winemaker, and it's exclusive in Dunn's store. So we're going to look at Spain and New Zealand today.
Okay, well, that's pretty far flung. Now, the two movies, must say, are we talking Call of the Wild, the Jack London book?
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely,
all right, okay.
Which has been adapted numerous times over the years. And I don't know why this book isn't on my radar, because in the States, basically, it's still in public. It's still in reprint since it was published in 1903. So I liked this, actually. I did like this, even though I was a little bit worried about... the cutest dog ever, if you see the trailer for this. But he's actually a CGI dog, so I was kind of worried about how real he would look. And you know, it's this kind of marriage. It's a filmmaker by the name of Chris Sanders directing, whose background is in animation. He did films including How to Train Your Dragon and Lilo and Stitch. And so it's a real marriage of live action and animation, I suppose, really. You've got Harrison Ford and a load of CGI dogs, really.
Okay, right.
But
okay,
it's
not a CGI Harrison Ford. It's a real Harrison Ford.
It's a real
Ford.
Harrison Ford, okay. Yeah. I didn't see the joins, really, so that was quite good. And it's kind of sweet. It's like, and I was wondering why we don't get to see films like this anymore, because it's kind of like that, you know, we've had storms the last two weekends and you just, like, don't leave the house on a Sunday afternoon and you just put the duvet over your head and with the kids and watch... a matinee, as we used to call them,
yes,
on the telly. And you know, there were lots of films like this. Ironically, this is one of the first releases by Disney following their Fox takeover, and it's a Fox film. But ironically, it kind of reminded me of those kind of Disney movies of 70s and 80s, where kind of all kind of set around nature and family pursuits and that sort of thing, you know. And I kind of thought, God, we don't really get films like that that aren't animated but aimed squarely at families anymore.
Yeah,
that kind of old-fashioned style to it. So I kind of liked it for that as well.
Well, like, could it be because I don't know, but maybe Call of the Wild is one of those books kids read at school, and so maybe because it is hugely popular in the States, you're right.
Huge,
so maybe this is more kind of, you know, they know there's something of a captive.
There's
market.
A traditional kind of feel to it that feeds into the book, I suppose.
Yeah, it's almost like kind of remaking a Dickens story.
Yes,
for Americans. So is it that kind of, it's pretty wholesome?
It's very wholesome, but it's kind of lovely as well. And you are rooting for the dog. It's a good old shaggy dog story. And as I say, it's midterm this weekend and you've probably run out of things to do with the kids at this stage. The weather is not great. And I think older children are really going to enjoy this. And I think they don't get to see films like this maybe as often as our generation would have. So I think it's going to go down well.
Downhill, also a remake, is it?
Yes, this is, do you remember me harping on about 5 years ago about a Norwegian movie called Force Majeure? It was a really kind of like sneakily funny, but also right on note, kind of black comedy directed by a guy called Ruben Östlund. And I was kind of like, see one foreign film this year, make it this one. Like, it was mm-hmm. really, really good. It's about this family who go on a skiing holiday. This is the original now. This one's very, very similar. But that one was about a family going on a skiing holiday. And they're kind of smug family. They're almost annoyingly smug at the yes. start. They're wealthy, they're well-to-do. But then there's a scene very early on, and it's one of the most stunning things I've ever seen on the cinema screen as well. There's a kind of a three-minute avalanche scene. It's a controlled avalanche, but the snow comes right down where they're enjoying their smug lunch on yeah. a balcony overlooking the mountains. And the husband legs it, basically. He takes his phone and he legs it and leaves the wife and the two kids there. And it just... The circumstances of that and the fallout from it kind of threatens the very fabric of their seemingly perfect marriage. So it's a great, great film. And what they're doing here is the US remake with Will Ferrell and Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Very similar in story to the original film, but just I think what made Force Majeure very special is it can be quite sad and snarkily funny at the same time. Mm. And there's a tone that's very difficult to get right. I suppose we could see it's done so well in Parasite only in the last few weeks, but these films are rare and they don't quite get that tone right. But I would say if you haven't seen Force Majeure, you'll probably get on fine with
yeah.
this remake.
Yeah, I've actually read nothing but poor reviews for it, really, but they all seem to have seen Force Majeure.
Yeah,
so,
it is. It's a shadow, you know.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of Parasite, one text already says, can't believe Trump's comments on Parasite winning the best Oscar. It's so frustrating that he manages to seep his toxic thoughts into every facet of life. There is no escape, says the text. Well, all he said was, what's that all about? So many great American films. That's my impersonation.
That was actually not bad.
But you need to do the hand action, you know, the little hands. As you know, Esther is responsible for every single decision that's made in the movie industry around the world. So answer for your crimes. Why have they greenlit a P.S. I Love You sequel? Who asked for another butchering of the Irish accent from Hilary Swank and Jared Butler?
I didn't know they were.
That's
either. News to me.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to say I was so manipulated by that film. I mean, I know it's not a great film, but I remember being the press screening in Savoy 1. And whatever mood I was in that day, I started sobbing about half an hour into it. I couldn't stop. I had to go.
As in, this is the worst movie I've ever seen, way?
No, I was just manipulated by it. And I had to go hide. And you know the way the ladies' toilets are in the back of the Savoy one?
Yeah.
I had to hide till all the other reviewers were gone because I'd big redhead on me.
Be drummed out of the reviewers' club. Has Esther subjected herself to Uncut Gems yet? This is the film on Netflix. I watched it the other night. I'm still annoyed by it. It's such a frustrating watch. Stressful even. It angered me at how annoying Adam Sandler was. Now he acted it very well. He was just incredibly unlikable. I haven't hated a character like that in a long time. I can't be the only one to feel this way, says Tony. I haven't seen it, but I haven't seen it either. But everything I've read is actually the way Tony describes it. It does seem like incredibly stressful. He's an incredibly nervy character.
I've heard the stressful thing, but I've only heard good buzz for it. So that's interesting that he found it so annoying, because I think I might as well, by the mere presence of Adam Sandler. I'm going to have to see it and see. You know?
It's a funny line. She doesn't touch in movies, but in books as well. Sometimes characters are so well drawn, they're intended to be annoying, and you're kind of reading and shouting at them. You hate them. So you can't say this is an enjoyable read or an enjoyable watch, you know. Also, a few questions for Jane. Can you please ask your expert to recommend a nice Vino Verde that's not too expensive, please?
Well, there is a good amount of Vino Verde now in the shops. I found a complete blank as to any of the brands, but it is a beautiful wine style. In fact, I was tasting at a competition in Germany this week, and we got a flight of Vino Verdes, which is such a coincidence. We've asked that question. Mm. And it's all made mainly from the Albarino grape, or Alvarina as it's called in Portugal. But they were beautiful, and they had that little bit of CO2 in it, and that lovely, it's light alcohol. It's usually about 11% ABV, and it's got all that lovely citrus flavour. I can honestly say that having tasted a flight of about 14 of them, they were all pretty similar in style. So, yeah, okay. Knock yourself out. Just go to the supermarket and find one.
Diplomatically put. Paul wants to know, a friend of mine has an unopened bottle of 1979 Bordeaux. The label says Roger Langel. Cazes, unpronounceable in the south of France. Is it safe to drink?
1979. I don't know much about that vintage, but see, the thing is, like, it depends on how it's been stored, and you know, I mean, you'll know when you open the cork. If it smells like terrible, then it's something's wrong with it.
Can you tell me what the craze is about this Whispering Angel? Why is it so expensive? Is it the celebs' drink of choice that hikes up the price?
No, I tell you what, it's a rosé from Provence and Chateau Miravel and Whispering Angel have become the sort of the really, really, and Domaine Ott is another one that makes these. It's these very light-coloured pink rosé wines, and they're quite expensive. Like a bottle of Whispering Angel is about €30 a bottle, and it's just caught the sort of zeitgeist of wine people and people who aren't really into wine. It's become terribly, terribly fashionable.
This is like the Cloudy Bay all over.
Yeah, it is
again.
Kind of like. But I remember going to a tasting. Oh, it was about 6 or 7 years ago of Domaine Ott, and the fellow who was the marketing manager who was over from France was telling us that bottles of the Provençal Rosé were selling in St. Petersburg at like €300 a bottle.
Crikey.
And again, it's all these sort of rich oligarchs, you know, they're rich kids who, you know, and I suppose that all kind of permeates down eventually, you know, that this light, you know, pale pink rosé from the south of France has become very fashionable with very rich people. So it kind of trickles down. And Whispering Angel is a brilliant wine, I have to say. It really is a very good wine and certainly worth the €30 that you charge. But there isn't a huge amount of it, so it's basically down to, you know, it's sellability.
Yeah, absolutely. And the shops have been able to say, oh, we've got it in, we got Whispering Angel in stock. Just briefly going back to chess, somebody's texted in to say, I was a manager in a hotel once and I threw a whole chess club out of the lobby because I can't stand chestnuts boasting in an open foyer. Let's move on to our first wine of the day. Glad you enjoy that, Jean. Esther has her head in her hands.
Okay, all right. Our first wine is from Spain. And again, it's one of the unique wines that is in the Super Value Spanish Wine Sale, which is running until the 4th of March. It's the 2018 Ostras Perini Versatilla. Now, Versatilla is the name of the grape variety, and it's not a grape I've ever heard of before. Anyway, this is actually on sale at €10, and it's from Valencia, or as they call it, Valencia.
Yeah.
I love Valencia, Valencia. I've been down there quite a lot. I've been to wine tastings there. I went to the America's Cup down there about 12 years ago. Lovely, lovely city. But their wine region isn't really that well known. Most of the wine that's grown is in northeast of the city in the sub-region of Alto Turia. And so this is it's not mainstream by any means. The winery, the Vincente Ganadia winery was founded in 1885, and it's actually one of the largest wineries in Valencia today. But this is a really unique white wine. It's made by a winemaker called Luis Garcia Severino from this Versatilla grape, which is white grape unique to the region. It's got very distinctive kind of lemon-lime flavours. It's very fresh. And the ABV again is 11.5. So this person who's looking for the Vino Verde, not dissimilar. And there even is the bit of CO2, as you can see, floating around in the glass. So it is quite similar to Vino Verde in style. And again, the lower alcohol, only 11.5%. That's, if you're watching your weight or watching your alcohol intake, that's really good. It's not dissimilar to Sauvignon Blanc as well. It has that slight grassiness that you get. But it's got a lovely, certainly the acidity is really lots of crisp acidity.
Yeah.
So serve it with any sort of fish. So if you're on the diet and you're having the fish and the salad, perfect wine to go with it.
Yeah, and 11%. Yes, yeah. Indeed. The hashtags, I can get a chance to read any of them out, is contagious movies, shingle white female, for instance. What movie would you like to do first?
Let's do Call of the Wild.
Okay, Call of the Wild coming after this.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Brought to you by Lidl's award-winning wine range. Lidl, more for you.
It's not that bad.
I lost my lead dog. We'll be 2 days behind if you're lucky. And we'll never be lucky.
Hang on.
Yeah. Get back. And mush!
There you go. That's Call of the Wild, or The Call of the Wild.
Yes.
So a story that probably a lot of people listening would be familiar with, nonetheless. What is it?
It's a shaggy dog story, really. It's about a pampered pooch named Buck, who's a blend of St. Bernard and a traditional US farm collie. And he's very big and he lives in this lovely house in California where the servants, because it's that kind of posh house, are used to picking up vases that he's knocked over just before they hit the ground and stuff like that. And it's quite nicely done. But it's 1903 and... it's a little earlier than that, actually. It's late 1800s. That's the year the book was published. But it's the dogs are all being moved up to Alaska, to the region of Yukon, where the gold rush is in full flight. And they need dogs to get them past the ice and the lakes to go mining for gold. So he's kidnapped. Poor Buck is kidnapped and brought, you know, from the warmth of California up to this place where he's literally never seen ice or snow before. There's a lovely sequence where he first tries to walk through snow. He doesn't know what's going on. And he kind of has to make a life for himself up there. And it's a bit Black Beauty, like some owners are better than others. Yeah. He has a few different owners. Those ones were a nice French couple who employ him as a sleigh dog. And that first scene there is... when he gets to lead the dogs, the pack of dogs, for the first time, and they're warning him that they don't know, they're warning each other, they don't know how strong he is. But there's a baddie dog as well. There was never a character in a movie called Spitz who was nice, really, was there? And he's...
what were you expecting in my name?
Yeah, he's a baddie dog. He's a husky who's kind of used to being top dog in the pack and not happy at all of this challenge. So, and he's not only got to handle human adversaries, but he has to handle canine ones as well.
Yeah.
Hope and redemption may come in the form of a kind of a loner, a man who's kind of got his own troubles in life and has kind of come to the region to escape those troubles. And that he's played by Harrison Ford, who's delightfully gruff here. When isn't he, says you?
Yeah.
But he plays it very well here, and he has a lovely... there's a lovely interaction between him and the dog, I have to say. It's lovely. And you do kind of end up believing your eyes, even though Chris Sanders and his team occasionally kind of go full almost animation with the dog. Like, you see a few times that he almost makes human-type expressions and reacting to things. Thankfully, though, he doesn't do it too often.
Yeah.
So you kind of, because that would just take you out of the film, you know. But he... yeah, he's sweet, Buck. He's not real, but he's really sweet. And I enjoyed this. And I really do think if you've got kids aged like 8 to 12 and you don't know what to be doing with them this weekend, I think this is a very special experience for them. I know Tara Brady in the Irish Times went to a Sunday screening and she wrote in a review today that there's one stage where Buck overcomes a baddie. She went to a Sunday morning family screening and there was one stage where Buck overcomes a baddie that the children spontaneously started applauding.
That's lovely.
So I think it's quite sweet. It's a bit slight, I suppose. You know, you are in three-star charity here. But I like that this exists and that it got made. And also, they have put a lot of work into making Buck look so real. Like they went on an exhaustive search across the states to find a dog. They eventually found a rescue dog that was the same breed as described in the book, and they scanned him, and they did the same for other dogs, and then they used like this CGI wizardry, really, and technology to, you know, create the dog, but CGI, but using real dog movements, I suppose.
Okay.
And then they had a guy called Terry.
Wouldn't they just get a dog and train it?
I suppose you've more like, because the dog's going to go, I don't feel like working today, I'm going to go over and have a pee, you know, when you're trying to direct him.
A union dog, a bit of professionalism.
And then they went full movement on it then, because there's this kind of legendary guy in the States called Terry Notary. He's a former, he's kind of like America's Andy Serkis, I guess. He's a former Cirque du Soleil performer and a stuntman, but he now works as a movement coach. So he played the dog, basically.
Okay, so for the actors, the human actors, it's something to interact with.
No, you're not talking to a tennis ball, you know, which you'd be usually talking on a set like that. And, the director made the, I actually interviewed the director for this, and he made the point that we now had a fully directable dog, you know, between the scans, the CGI, and the actual human playing the dog, that they were able to kind of sit down and discuss the dog's scene, you know, with Harrison Ford. So it all has the effect of looking kind of both hyper realistic and kind of distractingly mad at times, you know, but I did like it overall, and I do think it's very kind of wholesomely but also honestly geared towards its target family audience and designed really to entertain them.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Someone says, if you want a great dog movie, The Art of Racing in the Rain is very well. Well, we're not looking for a great. It wasn't like this item was entitled, we're looking for great dog movies. we're reviewing a particular movie that has dogs in it. Though somebody else says, you can't beat Marley and Me
when it
comes to dog movies. Nothing since has surpassed it. Unless buckets of puke you find.
No, it was traumatic, the ending of that. I was in.
You mean where the dog dies?
Spoiler.
The detail they go into the dog.
Oh
my God.
Yeah, the dog's final deathbed speech was really moving.
It was worse than P.S. I Love You, I swear.
Now, we haven't, no one in the studio has seen Uncut Gems, nor did we discuss it. Nonetheless, there's a load of text about it. That Adam Sandler performance captured that frenetic chancer gambler character in New York under huge stress on a 5 or 6 fronts almost perfectly in Uncut Gems. We here just don't appreciate the sheer intensity and pace these people live with every day. Says that, well, indeed, but I suppose he did it so well that probably there was a certain amount of people who were made feel uncomfortable from watching it. Owen says Uncut Gems is basically Good Time with a bigger budget. Also, wasn't Chewbacca basically a dog that learned to walk on its hind legs?
I really liked Good Time, so I'm a bit more interested now.
Yeah,
Good Time is great. Yeah, Lindy from a couple of years ago.
I did not know she was in this. And I don't even know what she looks like. I have to say, Idina Menzel was excellent in Uncut Gems. She's the woman from Frozen.
Yeah.
So nice to see her do something that wasn't Elsa or Glee. She was gritty and the perfect New York mob style wife. Okay. Mike says, I think Uncut Gems is an absolutely exceptional film. Can't believe it was snubbed by the Oscars. Adam Sandler acted out of his skin. Brilliant Oscar-worthy performance. I actually found his character likeable in a lovable rogue sort of a way. I was invested in him right from the opening scene. Best movie I've seen in quite a while. Says Mike. Though someone else says, now this is a film that we have talked about. I spent a lazy Tuesday watching Birds of Prey. I have to say Margot Robbie is very good. No, the movie is not great, but she can bring life to any character, to be fair to her. Pity the plot isn't that bit stronger and Ewan McGregor is a terrible villain. Margot is fab. The movie lets her down. Are they being overly generous?
A little overly generous, I think. Well, my main beef with it, it's a very dialed up performance from her. I'm a big fan of hers, actually. She seemed to be channeling Tonya Harding a little in a kind of fantastical
yes,
way.
Yes, yeah.
I think it might be just the accent there as well. But I find that character Harley Quinn very annoying in general. She's so OTT. It's a better performance than film for sure. And I totally agree with the Ian McGregor casting. It's just like the failure is in the casting there. I think he's just wrong for the job.
I was given an expensive, this is a very generalised question, I'm afraid, Jean. I was given an expensive bottle of red wine. I'd like to see if I could sell it. I don't like wine. Could your wine lady offer any advice? Where to go? Who might be interested? Any advice would be appreciated.
Well, I mentioned them earlier. Celtic Whiskey Shop actually have an online auction site. Okay, now they mainly specialise in premium whiskies, but they do have wine in there. So if you get in touch with them, they might be able, because it's very, very difficult to sell.
It's just a bottle, though.
A bottle. But you might, I mean, if you get in touch with them, they may be able to tell you if there's any value in it and if it's worth putting on the site and whatever. I don't know what arrangements they have. I've no idea, but that would be what comes to mind to answer that question.
Yeah. If I use wine in my cooking, does that make it not suitable for kids or those not drinking?
You see, once alcohol is boiled, there's no more alcohol in it. So, and certainly if you know, I think some of the great wine dishes make coq au vin, which is, you know, chicken cooked in white wine, basically.
Yeah.
Boeuf bourguignon, which is beef cooked in red wine. So, you know, if your kids like that sort of unctuous flavours and that richness, then yeah, I mean, but most kids I know to eat chicken nuggets, so I think it'd be very hard to get kids
coq au vin
to eat it.
Is lovely, hadn't I? Coq au vin a long time. Yeah. I feel like making that now. Here, yous are all wrong. Beethoven is the best Dougie movie out there, hands down. End of, simple as fact. Though Beethoven 2 and 3, I take or leave, they say. Ooh, quite the connoisseur of films then.
Beethoven's great. And you should take it from me as well. If there are dogs in a film, I'm going to give it an extra star by their mere presence.
People are still texting in about Uncut Gems. Saw Uncut Gems at the weekend. Fantastic. Usually detest Adam Sandler performances, but this one was made for him and he aces it. Though somebody else says, myself and my husband barely spoke for a week after watching Uncut Gems. I couldn't believe he would willingly subject me to that crap. Okay. Between wine names like Whispering Angel and perfumes like Hot Desire by Davidoff or someone, we put up with a lot of stupid names. Is that someone's actual job, says Jer? I imagine probably not. But is there, you know, the way when after Cloudy Bay, then there was a slew of wines with either Bay or Cloudy or something implying that. Is there kind of a lot of angel-y type
bay,
wines
the
now?
The Bay that is at Blenheim, the river that runs out to the sea, that is Cloudy Bay. That's what it's called in Marlborough on the coast of Blenheim. So that's where they got that name
from. They were totally entitled to the call
and
that.
I always remember the late, great Hazel Murphy. She ran Wine Australia. She sadly died at the beginning of this year. I remember once going to a lecture and she said, she was talking about Jacob's Creek, which was the Australian wine in the 1990s. And she said, actually, there is no such place as Jacob's Creek. I think there is, actually. I think there is. But but that was like, so yeah, they do come up with silly names. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Marketing, darling.
Indeed it is. All right. We do have to take a break back in a couple of minutes.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Brought to you by Lidl's award-winning wine range. Lidl, more for you.
Five, 3106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cent. Someone says, I heard they're redrawing the boundaries of the Bordeaux region. Does this mean that I will buy what I think is a Bordeaux and get something done? Actually, something else. We were just talking about that during the break and we looked it up. It seems to be a Burgundy thing, but they haven't decided anything yet. And as you can imagine, the winemakers are going absolutely nuts about any suggestions about doing that. But they are introducing new grapes.
What's actually happening because of global warming, they're going to start introducing grape varieties such as Touriga Nacional, which is one of the key red grapes from the Douro region in northern Portugal. And I mean, Douro is very, very hot. It gets up to 40 degrees in the summer. And Touriga Nacional can cope with that sort of heat. And now that because of global warming, Bordeaux is getting hotter. Now, they've got lots of different sort of cloned grapes and they're bringing back some very old grapes. But the big news grape that they're actually going to be introducing is Touriga Nacional, which will become a permitted grape. I think it's about 7 or 8 grapes. Now, what will basically happen? This isn't going to happen anytime soon. This will take a long time. And given that by the time you plant the grapes, it takes so long for you to actually be able to make wine out of it. And, you know, there'll be a lot of experimentation going on. So I wouldn't panic. But yeah. Yeah, they are. I know they're introducing new grape varieties because to combat the increase in temperature in the region.
Do Russians make wine?
Yes.
Somebody wants to know.
I was actually went to Anapa, which is on the Black Sea, in 2014, to a place which makes the most amazing sparkling wine, or you know, champagne. It was originally a winery built by Tsar Nicholas II to make champagne. Well, they're not allowed to call it that. Mm. But it's got exactly the same chalk soil. The wines are absolutely amazing. It was very interesting. There was a big wine fair as well, and a lot of producers from the Crimea had come over, and they were showing their wines. And yeah, they're all a lot of indigenous grapes. There's quite a few wine regions in Russia, and I've tasted quite a lot of the wines, and they were very good.
Yeah,
we just don't see them on.
We wouldn't see them in Ireland.
We wouldn't see them here.
Okay, that'd be interesting to try, I must say. We were. Somebody was asking about cooking with wine, and you know, if you cook it, does that take the alcohol out of it? Which it does. Gene referred to Coq au Vin. Someone's texting to say Woody Allen once referred to Coq au Vin as sex in the back of a lorry. I suppose you could describe it as that. The Uncut Gems is my film of the year. Sandler giving his serious side a showing. Awesome characterization. Edge of the seat, like watching a panic attack, seeing his world spiral out of control, and you know he's unable through addiction to stop it. It's absolute class. Made by another brother directing duo, the Safdie brothers, to be watched for future. See it, says Erica in Clonmel. And Sam wants to know, have you seen the new Bond film yet? I think Daniel Craig should have moved on from the franchise. Lately he looks a bit beaten down, a bit weary even. But he always looked a bit like that.
No, I don't think Daniel Craig has even seen the new Bond film yet, I'd say. It's not out till... We're getting it in April, so there'll be no time coming around. But that screening will be very late. It'll probably be only a matter of days before the release of the film. I kind of have high enough hopes for it, because I think they kind of... They've been kind of not rushing out one out every 2 years this time, and they've spent a bit more time with it. And also Phoebe Waller-Bridge is one of the co-writers on it. So I would hope there's a reason she's been brought in as a writer there, you know, to bring some maybe black humour and modernise it a little as well.
Yeah, from what I read, it was like there was a script, but she was brought in and went, well, what about this and what about that? And she kind of pitched various ideas at them, and which would be all it needs to kind of...
That would be the best use of her, actually, than writing it from scratch, you know, just come in with a different eye to it. Yeah. So I'd be hopeful enough.
Well, let's hope so. Let's move on to our second wine of the day.
Our second wine now. We're going to New Zealand, and a country I visited to. We've got some figures. New Zealand wine growers who promote New Zealand wines, they had an 8% increase in their wine exports in 2019. Everybody loves New Zealand. I mean, it's really popular. They just don't make enough wine to meet the global demand. I mean, here in Ireland, our market, we've an 8.9 million case market, and we would drink about 560,000 cases of New Zealand wine. So it's about 6% of the Irish market. So New Zealand is really, really popular in this country. And Dunn Stores have got an exclusive New Zealand wine, which I thought we'd feature today. Matt Thompson is the winemaker. Now, Matt makes wines in St. Clair. He works with Kim Crawford. As far as I know, he also makes wine in Italy as well. He's got a whole range of wines that he produces from Italy. He's a really, really good winemaker, and he's now making wines for this Rapaiora Springs. They're a family estate that are based in Marlborough. The Neelan family own the winery. They bought it in 1985, and they actually have, Matt is one of their winemakers. They have a whole slew of people working for them. But this is, I thought we'd go for New Zealand Pinot Noir, Marlborough Pinot Noir, as opposed to Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, because obviously everybody knows the Sauvignon. Mm. It's very, very popular. So this is the 2016 Rapaiora Springs Pinot Noir. It's on sale in Dunn's in 44 of their branches at €15. New Zealand Pinot Noir is just a very, very distinctive style of wine. Outside of Burgundy, we were talking about Burgundy there a few minutes ago, one of the few countries in the world that can really make really good Pinot Noir is New Zealand. They just do this so well. The first thing you can do by looking, this is 2016, so it's 4 years old. You can see that the wine is quite brown in colour. Well, take my word for it. I know I'm on radio, which showing a little bit of aging, and you've got that, you know, sort of development coming through on the nose, but on the palate, it's got dark cherry, plum flavours. It's beautiful layer of vanilla and spice. It's very, very soft. It's a very light. The thing about Pinot Noir, which again, is kind of keeping with the trend. People are going for lighter styles of red wine. They look like Beaujolais, Pinot Noir, anything that hasn't got too much tannin, too much concentrated fruit. It's just one of the trends that's happening in the wine world at the moment. People like the lighter styles of red. And this particular wine certainly meets that criteria. So you could serve this with, if you wanted a roast dish, venison or roast beef. But if you're a veggie or... Yeah, you could try it with beetroot and goat's cheese quiche.
Sounds delicious.
But a lovely wine.
Right, okay. the hashtag, by the way, I didn't get the chance to read out many of them, are contagious movies. Thrush Hour, for instance. Right, we'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is Downhill. Here's a clip.
All right, look, guys, this is what I'm thinking. I'm thinking we should just have some soup right now, and then we can have some of those yummy pastries at 4:00. Then we'll still be hungry for dinner. Doesn't that sound like a good plan, you guys?
Maybe we ski the beast after lunch.
I'll do that, Dad.
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't think it'll be that challenging. It looks black, but it skis red.
Really?
American blue. Yeah. Several of the black runs are American blue. European red. They just call them black for the prestige.
Where did you hear that?
I just know it. Yeah. It'll be fine. You can handle it.
How about this? Why don't we go and we find some good powder? And then we can get in some practice runs, you know, for the
rodeo?
Whatever that is. Right, okay, so as we were saying earlier on, it is a remake of, of a Norwegian film?
Yeah, yeah. Swedish-Norwegian, I think. It might be a co-production, sorry. I sound so...
Oh, your industry lingo.
No, sorry. But it is, it's a great film by Ruben Östlund. It is a remake here. Very similar in storyline. So what's happening there is the Smug Marrieds, played here by Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Will Ferrell, and their two kids are sitting on a balcony having lunch, planning their skiing holiday in an upmarket resort. They don't even try to surpass the avalanche scene that's in the original film, and that's a wise decision because it's stunning. Mm. But a controlled avalanche hits, and everyone's like staying put till the last minute because they don't know it's controlled allegedly. But the snow starts coming perilously close, at which point Will Ferrell's dad decides, I'm out of here, picks up his phone, mind you, not his kids, and legs it inside. So what was really good about the original film, and is done here as well, less effectively, I think, is the confrontation that follows that doesn't come until well into the film. Mm. So there's just a kind of an uneasiness between everyone in the family for the rest of the day, you know, an awkwardness, I suppose. But as in the original film, Will Ferrell's character knows it's coming for him because there's one stage where she says, we have to talk about this later. We'll give the kids some screen time. We'll talk about it over dinner. And he organises spontaneously for another couple who are in the resort to come and have dinner. And that's one of the best scenes in the original film, and done very well here as well, to be fair, where she's had enough. She has to say her piece. And this terrible row involving the two of them in front of the other couple kind of unfolds, where some vicious things are said, and the other couple respond in by her siding with her and him siding with him. So it's very, very clever. It's wickedly funny, like. But what they've done here, I think it's probably a wise move. I don't think you're ever going to get that sense of kind of sadness and pathos, because the stuff they're looking at here is like they're looking at an imploding marriage, but also it's really interesting stuff on keeping your own identity within a marriage, especially when you have children. And that's probably the best part of the original film. And I think just tonally, they just went for a drama here. It's more of a drama. The wicked sense of humour that was in the original film isn't there. So that's kind of why it pales, really. But then because of that, I don't think they would have ever got that tone as right again. That was a very special film, the original.
Yeah.
And because of that, I think maybe if you haven't seen the original film, you'd probably get more out of it. It develops into something quite touching, I would say, even in the last 10, 15 minutes. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus is great. And Miranda Otto, though, steals the film as this... this woman they meet in the resort who's like devil may care. She'll sleep with whoever she wants, even though she's married.
Ah, the slutty
Brit. She's almost theatrical about it, and she's very, very funny and a nice kind of moral compass, shall we say, to what else is going on in the film. You know?
Right, okay. Well, that doesn't sound that bad, actually. That's
all right.
Anyway, here's Annette Freeman to tell us about some good things to do this weekend.
Hi there. Tramore is an Our Girl Master of the Mic competition is back in O'Neill's Bar in Tramore tonight. Five singers, performers battled out to share a £1,000 cash prize. All monies raised will go to support Tramore Tidy Towns, and it kicks off at 9:30 tonight at Lone Little Theatre. They have a new production of Relatively Speaking on stage tonight. If you want tickets, at lonelittletheatre.ie. And this week's documentary on News Talk takes a trip back to 2002, wherein the greatest sporting icon in history sent a letter to the Armagh football team in a new radio documentary, The Alley All-Ireland Final, produced by Jonathan Farley, talks to Hugh Campbell, a member of the 2002 Armagh's coaching staff, who got Muhammad Ali to send a letter of inspiration to the team to go to glory. Saturday 22nd, that is on, that's tomorrow at 9 p.m. and it's also available on podcast on our website right now.
Good stuff. Thanks very much, Nettie. Thanks, of course, to Esther and Jean. Always a joy and a pleasure. That's our lot for today and for this week. Ivan's up next on News Talk. Our production team today, Claire Collins, Michael Quilligan and Anne-Marie Kane. We'll talk to you on Monday at 2 o'clock. See you then.